The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
It's my custom at the beginning of the year, first Monday evening talk of the year, is to give a talk on the Four Noble Truths. And this year I thought of doing that, but to do it a little differently than I have in the past, and that is to offer a series of talks in the four Mondays of January on some of the core teachings and principles of Buddhism. So a little bit like Introduction to Buddhism kind of series. And so tonight the idea was to talk about the core teachings of Buddhism. And since the Four Noble Truths is right at the core of the core teachings, I'll cover that as well. I think most people know that Buddhism began with the Buddha, who did not claim that he invented Buddhism. What he said was he rediscovered an ancient path. He rediscovered something that maybe has always been true. So it wasn't an invention. But it begins with a person, the Buddha. We don't know much about the Buddha. There's certainly a lot of myths that have grown up about him, and we're not even sure what his given name is. The name Siddhartha doesn't appear in the records until about 500 years after his death. So, how can we be sure that that was really his name? And the word Buddha is a title, like the word Christ is a title, and Buddha means the one who is awake. And so Buddhism is the ism of being awake. Wakeism. Awakeism. So what do you practice? I practice awakeism. That's quite nice, right? Being awake. You don't trouble anybody. You don't cause any problems for people if you practice awake. So and so there are a lot of stories about the Buddha, and it's hard to know, differentiate history from myth. But I'm quite fond of the myth because myths sometimes tell teachings, principles which are more colorful than sometimes reality, and that's kind of make more poignant, more stronger points. In the case of the Buddha, it said that he lived a privileged life, and he chose to leave that privileged life in order to try to discover for himself a solution or a escape solution's the best word to the common, most common existential struggles that human beings have to face. Sooner or later, I think pretty much everyone has to face sickness and death, and if you're lucky, you face old age. So sickness, age, old age, and death. And he didn't want to accept this as just given part of life exactly, because he saw that it brought him suffering, I guess some anxiety, and it certainly was quite distressing to people around him. And so he wanted to find, and the path of privilege that he knew, somehow didn't have the answers for him. The path of privilege somehow didn't have the meaning, perhaps, as sometimes it doesn't for people in the modern world as well. Either sometimes I know plenty of young people who grew up in privilege and choose something else as adults, choose a different route. Or I know plenty of people who, through hard work, have attained a life of success, financial success, career success. And then at some point they decide that it didn't measure up to what they were hoping for. It didn't have the same value that or the deeper value that they're hoping to imbue their life with. So the Buddha set out to somehow deal with these existential issues that he had confronted when he was about in his late 20s. And the route that he took, which was probably one of the only routes available to him at the time, remember this was 2,500 years ago, there was no IMC back there. You can just go down the street and get some teachings. There were no books, you know, you can't go down to Kepler's bookstore and get the latest and greatest books on Buddhism, there was very little options. There was no schools, universities to go to like they have now. And so the only option that was really available for him was to become a renunciant. And there was a tradition in his time of becoming a renunciant, of renunciant being someone who left behind the so-called household life, a life of being in relationships, having children, sexuality, having a lot of possessions. It was a life of kind of radical simplicity. And some people have likened a little bit to the life of some of the Greek philosophers who, it was a way of life for them. And so many of them lived a pretty simple life in the pursuit of truth, in the pursuit of a deeper way of life. And the Buddha's first efforts to get to the bottom of these existential issues was through meditation practice, particular forms of meditation practice that he figured at some point he succeeded at them, attained the meditation practices that were being offered to him, and he found that they didn't have any meaning, or they didn't solve the suffering issue, the issue of suffering that he was trying to address. And so he looked further afield, and one of the most common, one of the strong traditions of his time was a tradition of asceticism. And there was a variety of philosophies around asceticism. One of them was that if you did enough asceticism, tormented your body enough, you could burn off all your bad karma. And when you had no more karma, not only your bad karma, but your good karma too, you burn off all your karma. And when you no longer had any karma that was kind of sticking to you and kind of weighing you down, it set you free. And one of the important, one of the very important traditions of his time was the Jain tradition, which still exists in India today. And to be set free, totally free, was synonymous with dying. So when your karma was completely exhausted, you died and kind of went to some kind of liberated state. And so the Buddha tried asceticism as well. And at some point he decided this was not going to help him with his search for a solution to a transcendence or transformation of suffering. Now, I think it's quite significant to reflect that what the Buddha was looking for was some kind of solution to suffering. That was the term, that was the kind of dukkha is the word. He was not looking for something which was what we could call kind of supernatural. Many religions have a supernatural element to them. You want to discover God, and that's the whole point. Or you want to study, you want to discover perhaps the true nature of consciousness, cosmic consciousness perhaps, or oneness with the universe, or some larger kind of principle, supernatural, transcendent kind of principle. The Buddha, in a sense, was looking at something which everyone can relate to, which is suffering. There's very few people who would claim that they don't suffer. And suffering is something that you can experience for yourself. God, a lot of people wonder, is God exists? You can't. Some people have no clue how to experience God. Normally can't see God. There's a lot of things, there's a kind of supernatural world that people don't see in the same kind of practical way as you can see suffering. So suffering is tangible. So what the Buddha was looking for was something that was a solution, something tangible, something we all can experience. So it's very human. And I'm actually quite fond of how human, or how kind of basically human or practical Buddhism tends to be. So then he he decided to give up the asceticism. And he engaged in, once again, in a path of meditation, but now from a different angle. And the angle he took now was, rather than starving his body and tormenting his body, he was going to take a path of what he could call meditative pleasure and joy. So rather, because the ascetic tradition tried to avoid joy and pleasure. And sensual pleasure, pleasure that you got from stimulating the senses, was a little bit taboo in those ancient renunciant traditions. So that was out of the question. He couldn't go get a massage. He could, but meditation provided an inner sense of well-being that was, in a sense, sense-free, sensation-free. It wasn't being stimulated, wasn't arising because your sensations were being stimulated. You weren't seeing something beautiful, hearing something beautiful, feeling something beautiful. It arose kind of from the inner life, rather than from the the sensory life. So he thought that might be a way. And so he started practicing meditation that brought him a fair amount of calm, stability, and well-being. And from this vantage point of his calm, stable well-being, he began having insight into what he called the nature of his life, nature of kind of how life is structured, how life occurs. Or more specifically, he started to get insight into how suffering occurs in human life. And this is where myth comes in again, because one of the myths that, whenever you call a religious tradition, whenever you say the religious tradition has myths, I suppose it's disrespectful to the tradition, right? Because they don't think it's a myth. Except I'm not one of, I'm one of them, so I guess I can say it. So the first thing that, first insight he had in the process of his awakening was, in this mythic version of it, was he saw his past lives. It says he saw life after life after life going back, a phenomenal length of time. And he just saw the sequence of his lives. The second thing he saw was he saw that in all the people around him and all the beings around him, they would die and get reborn. And they got reborn according to how they lived their lives, the ethical principles or the intentional motivations that guided their lives. So what he saw was, in those two insights, is he saw life as a process. And he saw it as kind of a cyclic process of rising and passing away, rising and passing away. And he saw that that process of rising and passing away was being driven or being perpetuated by people's intentional life, by what was motivating their minds. Minds that were motivated by greed, they would reach out in order to get reborn. Whatever the nature of the intention, the quality of that intention affected the quality of that rebirth. So someone who harmed other beings might end up in a rather unfortunate rebirth. Those who did wonderful things, acts of generosity and kindness to others, would get to be reborn in beautiful states of being afterwards. So the quality of the rebirth was affected by how ethical their life was. Now, prior to the Buddha, it said that there was in India a theory of rebirth. And also, prior to Buddha, much broadly in India, there was a theory that people got, when they died, they went off to some kind of heavenly realm. That was maybe somewhat vague about. But there was no sense that how one lives one life, how one, the ethics, ethical integrity in which one lives one's life, affected that process of rebirth. And so what the Buddha contributed to this kind of Indian theory of kind of what happens to you when you die is he said there's an ethical quality that affects that process. How you live affects what happens next. It's kind of like you set up a habit, and based on your disposition, the disposition affects how you get what happens next. So he became interested in this. So what he saw life as a process. And whether we believe in these past lives or not, still he saw began seeing life as a process. And the process that was motivated by the quality of our mind. What was going on in our own mind? The intentions, the motivations, the quality of what we wanted and not wanted. And then as he looked more deeply, he had a third insight. And this is the insight which is considered to be uniquely Buddhist, the Buddhist contribution to all this. And what he saw was that one of the key things that perpetuated the process of life and death, or the process of suffering, being caught in the world, or the process of suffering, was he saw He saw that suffering and the process of rebirth was clearly a process, and he saw how that process functioned. So rather than seeing who he really is, who he really was, rather than seeing the true nature of self, or rather than seeing the true nature of God or the true nature of reality, what he saw was he saw the true nature of the process which gives rise to suffering. And he saw that if you took some of the elements away from the process, the suffering would drop away. It's kind of like if you have a product of two numbers. If you take away one of the numbers and try to, you know, if it's x times y, make y zero, then the product is zero too, right? Isn't that how it works in mathematics? So, or to say it in a different kind of mathematical way, there was a strong tendency in Indian religions to see that the world of impermanence was a world of suffering. And but the equation prior to the Buddha among some people was that impermanence, the world of impermanence, equals suffering. So in order to not have suffering, you have to take away the impermanent side of the equation, which led to a lot of transcendent kind of thinking, where you're supposed to leave the world entirely in order to become liberated, not having to do with the world. The Buddha, I think, had a little different equation, and that would be that suffering, impermanence, times clinging equals suffering. And so you didn't have to get rid of the world of impermanence in order to end suffering. You could bring the clinging to zero. And then the impermanent world of impermanence would not lead to suffering. So what he saw was he saw a process by which clinging operates. And the simplest formulation of that process is the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths starts with suffering. Since suffering is the issue that the Buddha was trying to address, that's why he left his privileged life to become a renunciant, to deal with the issues of suffering. That sometimes, and to understand the gravity of this issue of suffering, it's often equated with sickness, old age, and death. So that's the first noble truth, that, you know, the truth of suffering. There is suffering. The Buddha did not say that life is suffering. That's the same thing as saying impermanence equals suffering. He did not say that. But there is suffering in life, but life is not suffering. There might be a lot of suffering in life. There might be so much for some people that they could just about say life is suffering. But it's very important not to say that, because if you say that, then, you know, it's the only way out is complete rejection of the world. So the but the first noble truth is the truth of suffering, and there's a practice associated with the first noble truth. So it's not just simply a truth that you're supposed to believe, like a tenet of religion. It's meant to be more like an orientation or a frame of reference. If what you want is liberation from suffering, you need to have a certain framework, orientation, or map by which to kind of negotiate your way through life to find the goal of liberation. And that map or that orientation begins by becoming sensitive to suffering, to tuning into it, getting to know it. So the practice associated with the first noble truth is the practice of getting to know your suffering. So the bumper sticker for Buddhists would be, I stop for suffering. And now, it's we'll see later in this talk, hopefully, that this is not such a depressing endeavor, but it's supposed to be something that we engage in with great hope and possibility. That this is actually kind of a very positive message, because it's a message that leads to this liberation from suffering. So the second noble truth is a truth that says that suffering arises from clinging, from grasping. The second noble truth does not say that suffering arises from desire. There's plenty of even books in the West that will try to say that Buddhism teaches that suffering is a source of that desire is a source of suffering. The Buddha clearly did not say that. He was very careful with the word he chose to describe as a source, the origin of suffering, the cause of suffering. He used the word thirst. Thirst has this quality of kind of compulsion, of grasping, of clinging, of kind of drivenness. There's a kind of drivenness. You can have desire without compulsion. You can have desire without suffering. My desire is like a dime a dozen. They just kind of roll out of my mind like no one's business. But most of them, I just let them roll away. You know, here they go, and there they go. You know, I don't pick them up. They don't cause me any suffering at all. Just, you know, they just come along. And easy come, easy go. Some desires are quite healthy to have. It's kind of inconceivable to have a life without desire. Nowadays, I think there's a strong tendency to associate people who don't have any desire as being depressed. So the point is not to get rid of desire, but the point is to understand that there's a certain kind of desire, a particular kind of desire called clinging or grasping or drivenness or compulsion, which gives rise to suffering. To say this in a different way, maybe upside down, in a way that maybe makes it a little bit clearer, is rather than saying first suffering and then the cause of suffering is clinging, I like to say it this way. If you cling, you will suffer. If you let go of that clinging, you let go of that suffering. So if you cling, you will suffer. Let go of that clinging, the suffering goes away. So the task in Buddhism is then the practice, or in the second noble truth, is to see clearly the nature of that grasping and to let go of it. The third noble truth is the complete letting go, the cessation of that suffering, the experience of letting go. This is the kind of the good news in Buddhism, that it's possible to overcome suffering. And today I was talking to someone who is going to teach mindfulness at a very prestigious psychiatric school in San Francisco, at a major university in San Francisco. And she had all these psychiatrists around. She was kind of introducing what she was going to do. And she said something like, you know, mindfulness has become quite popular in our culture now as stress reduction and pain management. And but, you know, that's not the original thing it was designed for. And as we do kind of, shortchange ourselves, that's all we use mindfulness for. The real purpose of mindfulness in its Buddhist context is to bring suffering, all suffering, to an end. And this woman, as she was telling me this, she said as she gave that talk, all these psychiatrists, their mouths dropped open. And as she experienced it, was they were just kind of in awe, stunned, that anyone would, that was a possibility. Rather than, they said, mostly what we do is we medicate people. So it's the good news. But because it's not easy to let go of clinging, it's easy to say you should let go of it, it's hard to do. There is then the fourth noble truth. And the fourth noble truth is there's a path, there's a way, there's a process to engage in that can help you dislodge that clinging. Some clinging can get dislodged easily and quickly. Some takes a lot of time and a lot of deep inner work, a lot of challenging oneself, maybe wrestling with oneself even, in order to get down there to the bottom of the places where we cling, in order to let go of them. So the Buddha offered a path. Now, in all four of these, he is still talking about a process. He's a process because suffering is not, you know, if suffering was just a thing that existed in the world in a solid way, like a piece of granite, you know, just there. You're born with it, and you have a certain amount, then you die with it. Then there's not much you can do. But because it's part of a process, you can engage that process and change the process, or you can bring that process to an end. So I can't underscore enough how much the central teachings of Buddhism are process-oriented rather than essence-oriented. Buddhism doesn't look at essence in terms of substantial essences of things, the true nature of the self, the true nature of reality, the true nature of ultimate reality, whatever. What it's trying to look at is something in some ways more humble, which is, what is the process by which we suffer? And how can we work with that process to bring suffering to an end? So then there's a variety of teachings in Buddhism that then expand on this these principles of process, expand and bring a greater and greater understanding of this process, different angles, different perspectives. But they all have perspectives on process, how to work the process. The Eightfold Path is a simplistic way of encapsulating a whole series of practices a person can engage in that begin shifting and changing the inner processes of your mind towards healthier processes. So, you know, someone who doesn't do any kind of inner work at all may or may not have healthy inner processes, mental processes. And there's quite a few people who have quite healthy, unhealthy ones. The argument would be anybody who suffers has an unhealthy mental process going on. And so we want to take some responsibility for what goes on in our mind. And this side, since Buddhism also has a very positive view of the human mind, human heart, human mind, heart is the same, in that it sees it as a process, the processes can be changed. Since the mind is not a thing in Buddhism, it's an activity or a series of activities. And since it's activities, the activities can be shifted and changed. It's quite malleable. If the mind was a simple, hard, fast thing, then you can't change it, can't move it around. In other words, to use a modern analogy, the mind is software. And the software can be reprogrammed, rechanged, redone. And in a kind of funny way, perhaps, maybe it's not quite right, but Buddhism doesn't believe in any hardware. it's all software. So one of the core teachings of Buddhism is a teaching of karma. And you can begin appreciating why the teaching of karma is central now that you understand that the process is so important. Because karma tries to explain how this process unfolds over time. So at its most basic idea, karma teaches that our actions, what we do, is consequential. And a lot of people believe that in ordinary life. If you're going to learn to play a musical instrument, like a piano, you start playing the piano, you practice. You practice with some kind of belief that if you practice, you'll get better. Most people don't practice unless they believe they're going to get better. To believe you're going to get better by practicing is to believe in karma, to believe that your actions have consequences. And more specifically, to believe that you can also train yourself in certain skills. Your mental ability to play a piano is an activity. You're tapping into activities of the mind, and they're malleable enough that you can change and train what's going on. So in order to engage in this path of liberation that Buddhism teaches, you have to have confidence or a certain level of belief that what you do is consequential. So we're going to train ourselves in a variety of different trainings in order to develop ourselves. So one of the key trainings in Buddhism is the trainings in kindness and compassion. And So once you kind of understand the Four Noble Truths as principles, ways to look at your life, you look at suffering, you look for the clinging, you look for the possibility of release. Once you understand that's a valuable kind of framework for looking, or map for looking at our life, the next task, once you understand that, is to engage in this, to evoke an attitude, an approach of kindness and compassion. That's the second step of the Eightfold Path. So rather than taking suffering as being this big downer, we understand suffering, and then we try to elicit whatever degree of kindness and compassion towards ourselves and others as we set out in a path to try to make a difference, to try to shift our mind so our mind can move towards freedom. And then the middle stages of the Eightfold Path have to do with our behavior, ethics, living a life of integrity. Not really because it's the moral thing to do, but rather an ethical life creates the conditions in the heart and mind that makes it easier for the heart and mind to be stable and insightful. It's if you spend a lot of time lying and stealing, chances are you'll be agitated. Chances are you'll be a little bit numb. Chances are you'll be a little bit disconnected from yourself. If you want to be awake and clear, if you want to be calm and sensitive and connected, it really helps to live an ethical life. And it's quite remarkable to watch people who do a lot of mindfulness meditation or a lot of Buddhist practice that their ethics tends to become better and better over time, because as they get more sensitive, they realize that if they do something unethical, it kind of just messes up the water. It doesn't support this process of developing greater inner integrity, stability, and ability to kind of get deep into the mind. So I think it's a natural thing for people engaged in Buddhist practice that as the practice develops, they become more ethical. Some people choose to become more ethical first in order to support the practice, and some people practice first and then let their ethical development follow in the wake of their practice. Either way is fine, as long as you don't cause harm. And then the last three parts of the Eightfold Path have to do with the mental development. So the middle path has to do with your behavior, adjusting your behavior, changing and making behavioral changes in your life. And the last three have to do with now beginning to engage in the processes of your life, and the mental processes of your life. And so this is taking some responsibility for what goes on in your minds, and realizing that we can take responsibility, we can adjust, we can change what goes on in the mind. We don't have to take what's going on in the mind as a given. I know that for many of us, we might suffer, be depressed or upset about something, and we can spend a lot of time trying to think and feel and address and do something to try to make a difference. It just seems like it's just locked in there. But it's certainly possible with a variety of different practices of mindfulness and concentration and calm to be able to begin dislodging and loosening up the structures of the mind so they're not frozen, but become softer and softer. And so eventually we can kind of get down and see how the process works and see what is extra, what can be taken out of that equation. As I say in my intro class, certain emotions are frozen in us. So, for example, resentment is frozen anger. And if something is frozen, it's hard to really get in there and make a difference. But if we can thaw the ways in which the mind is frozen, then we can start letting things begin to move again. And once they begin moving, then we're back into the process. And once they're back in the process, we can start making a difference in that process, shaping it, affecting it. So a big part of Buddhist spiritual life is helping that thawing process occur. And one of the important ways that happens is through a lot of kindness and compassion, and also through a lot of presence. Just being present, being fully present for what our experience is. And this kind of full presence has a lot to do with no longer adding constriction around what's happening in our life. Just be present in an open way, being present. So then there's this development of the mind that goes on. And it has a lot to do with mindfulness, has a lot to do with concentration. So after the Buddha, right after the Buddha was enlightened, he decided to go teach. Five of his companions who had accompanied him during his many years of ascetic practices, so fellow ascetics. And when the Buddha had given up his ascetic practice, he had received from someone a gift of very rich, creamy rice porridge. And he drank it in order to get strength. And his fellow ascetics were disgusted by how he had renounced his asceticism. And I mean, can you imagine, for an ascetic, you know, that's kind of, really, that's pretty bad, right? So they left him in disgust. And but he decided to find them after his enlightenment in order to teach them. He thought that they were actually fairly highly developed in their spiritual life and that he could go and teach them. When they saw him coming in the distance, they made a pact among themselves. They said, "Here comes that guy who's, gone soft, gone back to the soft life. Let's not stand up and greet him. Let's just stay in our seats, stay present, and kind of ignore him, I guess." And as he approached, as the story is told, as he approached, they were unable to keep their pact. As he approached, there was something about his presence that compelled them to stand up and greet him and offer him a seat. Something about his presence. So it's easy to read the principles and the teachings of Buddhism in books, and some of them can seem quite lofty, some of them can seem quite abstract, some of them can seem very logical. But it's a whole different thing to be in the presence of someone who's free. It's a whole different thing to be in the presence of someone who's practiced. And there's a variety of things we can pick up from someone's presence. But there's presence there. And that sense of presence got his five companions to stop and be willing to listen to what he had to teach. And then he taught the Four Noble Truths. And they said at the end of that first teaching, one of the ascetics got it, was set free. So this juxtaposition between presence, the presence of freedom, that's so immediate, that's here, that's not abstract, that's palpable, it's kind of in the air. And then this teaching that points towards how to reach that radical presence. That combination, I think, is quite significant. So not to hold it as just abstractions, but not to hold it as just presence without an explanation, without a path, but to bring those two together. And so the Eightfold Path is a path that converges, that leads to, that collapses onto the presence of liberation, liberated presence. What that presence or what that experience of liberation is, the Buddha did not teach much about. The core teachings of Buddhism says very little about what a liberated person is like, what that liberated experience is like. And that's led a lot of people to a lot of frustration. It's led to a lot of ink as people have tried to guess what it might be like. But I think it's more productive to consider why the Buddha did not teach much about what liberation experience liberation is like. For one thing, maybe it's not very helpful. Maybe what's helpful is to show you the map of how to get there. And so the Buddha emphasized in his teachings, almost entirely, those teachings, that way of life, those practices that can soften, thaw out the heart and the mind, help us to see how the processes of our own mind, the activities of our own mind actually function. And then give us the ability, show us the insight, point us toward the insight that can help us to dislodge the clinging, the grasping, that then sets the mind free. And once that's happened, you don't need to know what that's like, because you know. You need to be told about it. I say it this way, you don't need to know because you are it. And that's a better way of saying it. You don't need to know because you are it. So, somewhere halfway through this talk, I realized that I'd set myself up for problems by saying I was going to, in 45 minutes, talk about the core teachings of Buddhism. How could I do that in 45 minutes? But, so be it. And I think next week it's the core practices. And then, I forget the sequence I set it up, but the core practices, the core attitudes, and the core realizations are the four topics for this month. So I hope this works as a kind of introduction to Buddhism. Thank you.